Kia ora, welcome to episode 39 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I sit down with Otupoti-based artist Simon Khan at Sanderson Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau. Simon is of Ngāi Tahu, Chinese and Pākehā descent. He has a Diploma of Fine Arts with honours from Otago Polytechnic. His work is held in numerous public and private collections, including the University of Waikato Collection at the Arts House Trust and the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna Oewhitu Collection. He also has been the recipient of several art awards and residencies. Simon is represented by Sanderson Gallery in Auckland, Gallery 33 in Wānaka, and De Novo Gallery in Dunedin. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Simon Khan Instagram post for your reference. In the episode, you'll hear Simon speak about the influence of his Chinese, Māori, and European whakapapa on his life and practice, how the absence of a Western art aesthetic growing up made art school more challenging, but also allowed him to create his uniquely own work, the significant influence of Marilyn Webb, his encounters with Ralph Hotori and a kind of parallel of Ralph's painting that Simon sees in his own work, and his ongoing collaboration with ceramicist and uku maker Wi Taipa. We started by talking about where art did and didn't fit into his childhood.
You know, I never thought of myself as the artist in the class. And I remember being terribly disappointed. I was probably about 9, where there was a visiting artist, I think, or, you know, back then in the 70s, as much as you had a visiting artist. We all had to draw something to see if we're good enough to go and be, you know, because I think she only probably could have 10 students. But I didn't get selected. And I remember just like thinking, I was really gutted. You know, not because I thought I was the best drawer, but I really wanted to go into that class and do that with her. And yeah, it just sort of triggered just recently. I hadn't thought about it for probably 40 years.
But maybe a determination to lean more into making?
Yeah. I mean, I was always a really physical kid. Like, we grew up in a pretty rural area just out of Dunedin. And, you know, I was always running around the farms and playing rugby and doing judo and... You know, I was really, really sporty, and I was a runner, sprinter. I used to do a lot of competitive sport. So sport was a big part of my life. You know, so the art thing was just a thing on the side. And I wasn't, you know, the art kid, I suppose. I was the sport kid. I think about that relationship a little bit too, actually, that physical nature of that love for that adrenaline or just that engagement with having that physical sort of approach and how that relates to my art practice.
So there's a bit of an adrenaline rush that you can get out of the right bit of making?
Yeah, I mean, adrenaline's, I suppose, one way to look at it, but I think it's something a bit different from adrenaline. It's about being fulfilled. It's about a fulfillment, you know, it's about making you whole. So all these things that make you whole, the sum of the parts, really. And there is a real similarity of that.
It sounds like you're also suggesting, though, that making, even if it was as a kid, was a way to balance out all of that physical activity as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. Like maybe a more intellectual pursuit to balance out.
It's about achievement, too, I think. Like the more I'm just off the cuff, really, the more I'm just sitting here. It's about achieving, you know. It's about winning a race or winning a rugby game or fighting someone at judo and winning. I was really driven to win things, but not because I wanted to. But I think often it's about because I didn't want to lose. I didn't want not to win. I didn't want to win necessarily. I just didn't want to lose.
Yeah.
And I think arts for me it's similar, but it's an internal thing. Like I'm not trying to win, you know, in the art world. I'm just trying to win with these things I'm making.
Your own standards. You're trying to achieve as best you can for Simon.
Yeah, but, you know, having high standards with that as well. I've never thought of myself as a perfectionist because I'm pretty rough as guts with a lot of stuff. But like, there's lots of energy that goes into everything.
Does that come from a family background?
Not really. No, my parents were both very pretty cruisy. My father, you know, spent most of his life in the market gardens and in the fruit shop and down in Port Chalmers. And my mum was a nurse and a carer and both amazing gardeners. You know, my father had, from an early age, worked in the market gardens down in Sawyers Bay and tended to those with his family and his siblings and his parents. And I remember, like, he talked about the spades when he used to come home from school and have to dig the gardens, and the beautiful old spades that we've still got actually have big divots the other way around from the amount of use they've had, you know, and him tending those. And then my mum with, you know, the rose gardens and, you know, the traditional female gardening, I suppose.
I obviously want to ask about the influence of, you know, Chinese and Māori heritage whakapapa that flows into the practice. But before we even do that, were both of those cultures really present in your childhood as well?
In some ways. Our family had a really strong, where I grew up in Sawyers Bay, there was a really strong hub of community and whānau. Like, all my Chinese cousins, a lot of them lived, we all lived within 200 metres of each other. Yeah. Dad was born here and his siblings were born in New Zealand. Both my grandparents came over from China and they never went back to China, any of those siblings really, or had the drive to or felt the need to, because there was a lot of assimilation, you know. And both my grandparents had passed away on my Chinese side before I was born, so I never got to meet them. So my main association with the Chinese culture was food. So, you know, we ate, you know, Chinese meals and Dad would cook them and Mum learned to cook them as well. And also probably the artwork. You know, my grandfather collected quite a lot of artwork, really, and you know, silk painting things and vases and things that we grew up with.
And I have this idea that maybe from a, like, your mum's side of the family, Māori side of the family, that you're maybe just young enough to be part of maybe the resurgence of post-Māori urbanisation. So, you know, there's not a complete disconnect maybe from marae or whānau in that sense.
No, there was a big disconnect actually for us.
It's funny because I guess you were in that, maybe you were just young enough, but I guess you're in that middle generation. There's so many young Māori artists now that are like totally connected.
Yeah, that's right. And I think about my kids and how much they're more connected now than I was ever at that age.
But not a lot of time at Lookamurai.
Not much, yeah. And through high school, I was never encouraged to look into anything of being Māori at school. I didn't do any kapaka, I didn't do te reo. It wasn't even in my psyche. You know,
yeah.
Kids now, like, have grown right up with it, which is amazing.
Yeah, I've got that wrong then about generations. And
no, so, you know, the 70s and 80s, it was a pretty cultural desert for us, especially in education. You know, it's at home, you know, as I said, it was a real hub because my lovely, beautiful Scottish grandmother lived next door to us, and she was very much, you know, matriarch of the family. Lovely. I was really privileged to grow up with her. But all my whānau would all my cousins, all my Māori cousins would always come and hang out, you know, from Christchurch and, you know, around. And so that was kind of a connection there. And, you know, and my aunties, some of my aunties were more connected, you know, into that world as well. But my mother wasn't so much, you know, they were when they were younger. But then when she immersed herself into my father's sort of Chinese whānau when she moved to Sawyers Bay.
So how was that? Because it sounds like then Chinese culture was really strong, really present. How has Māori culture achieved a greater footing in the last two or three decades with you?
Yeah, it was probably through art school, through my art, through art making. Yeah, I had mentors back at art school. I had Marilyn Webb.
Yeah.
Who was an amazing mentor for me.
Is she someone that, as a quick aside maybe here before we talk about making, is she someone that influenced you as a printmaker?
Obviously, yeah. She was an amazing, as an artist, really, she was a real stickler for getting things perfect and right and, you know, around process. She wouldn't even look at my, she wouldn't even want to know what my work was about unless it was printed perfectly. I'd go and show her and I want to talk to her about the ideas in it. She wouldn't even want to know about them if they weren't printed perfectly, if it wasn't technically spot on. So she was great though. And once she got through that, she would just opened up and really encouraged me. And even she identified things that I didn't even know that were Māori when I was in my work. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the first person to, I did this flying figure in the sky. And she goes, "Oh, you've done a manaya, Simon." She named it, you know, and I go, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, we're going to always end up jumping around a little bit, I suppose, in these conversations.
That's but fine.
Now that we're talking about early work, it was a work that I wanted to ask about called Manipulation, which is from 1992. So admittedly, you're only, I think, 21 years old when you make this work. So really
Drink
early work. But even in that work, I guess there's a suggestion already that you're like, oh, there's actually a Māori culture that I can call on in a practice, because it looked like it was a bit of an exploration of whakapapa and where Māori sit in the universe. And by the way, reference for listener, I'll include an image of that work, Manipulation, on the Simon Kahn Good Oil Instagram post for you.
I don't want to derail that, actually, Graham, because that work was more around, I was an angry, tormented young artist back then, and I was actually really into German Expressionism around that time.
Huh.
Yeah, and that was like this kind of really grunty...
well, you're 21, you're trying stuff out.
I was into like Carl Apple and those kind of characters who are doing big, chunky, grunty works. And it was kind of around the manipulation of the system, you know, and how we were kind of all part of that system and being manipulated. And I suppose with me trying to think about how can I break free from that and go on my own pathway without being... just part of the piece of the bigger puzzle, or not the puzzle, but the machine.
Well, as I say, it's a, you know, you were 21 when you made that work. It's really different from where the practice is now, and where the practice pretty quickly evolved to. So that work, you're right, it's chocker full of, I guess, energy and there's a lot of figures, etc. in it.
Yeah.
How did you evolve the practice pretty quickly to one that is a lot more sparse, meditative?
I can go back through to my primary school times, actually, and even my high school times, where I said before that I wasn't the art star, I wasn't the person who was that kid, and it was because I had a different aesthetic knowledge, but it took me years and years and years to work that out. Because of I can go back to those Chinese artworks I had in our house. To me, that was art. And I didn't have that same Western aesthetic. Nothing was taught, but it's just as I was growing up, that was art. And I didn't know how to unpack that probably until maybe my third year, my last year at art school or my fourth year at art school.
But it's sitting in your subconscious the whole
sitting
time.
Sitting in my subconscious. But I failed. That's why I failed art, really. Not, you know, didn't fail. Just got through. And even those first 3 years at art school, I just did enough to get through.
You think you failed because you weren't creating work that was Western enough?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I didn't have a Western perspective. I couldn't understand that Western perspective of art, and it just never gelled with me. So it wasn't until probably my last year at art school, it was my honours year, where it just started to click. And there's things like Marilyn unpacking things, you know, and thinking about Māori art, I suppose, too, and how that could help me unpack and start to sort of diffuse that Western perspective as well. So both the Māori and the Chinese aesthetic go totally against the grain, obviously, you know, of that Western, of that, that
well, especially canon. And especially in New Zealand, in Aotearoa at the time, no one would have been making work like
really.
The young you wanted to.
Yeah, no, exactly. There wasn't much there for me to reference, so I had to make it up myself. And I think I still am making these things up myself. God, I don't know. People look at for points of difference with artists. You know, that is, I suppose, my point of difference without knowing it.
Well, yeah. let's maybe talk about the elements of the work that do call on both Chinese and Māori elements. So if we maybe... Forgive me for being too maybe blunt with this, but if we call on the Chinese elements, you know, first, there seem to be lots of them in the work. So the first one I wanted to ask about was that so much of the work, regardless of the support that they sit on, seem to reflect paper as a support, even if they're, as I say, made on board. the surface quality of the work looks like paper a little bit. So by design?
Yep, that's interesting. I mean, this sort of weaves into the painting printmaking conversation. I mean, because it started with paper. You know, I was trained in printmaking. Marilyn was my mentor. My major was printmaking. And that paper was a big part of me getting to know material and to understand that. And yeah, these complementary practices over the last 30 years, you know, have bounced off each other. And yeah, interesting with the idea around the more ephemeral nature of paper as opposed to, yeah. And it's the same with, you know, those washes and things. And because I use a lot of washes in my work now, even more so. Sometimes I think about it as skin, you know, like a thin skin. That's why, you know, sometimes I carve into the work and it's like carving to the skin. Between that and water, obviously, you know, between that and water and those elements of liquid, because we work with, you know, it's liquid. And getting to feel the, or getting to understand that or work with it.
And I might be drawing a little bit of a long bow here, but paper, ultimately a Chinese invention. So I wondered if that was something that you wanted to nod to.
Well, I mean, that's another tribute to Marilyn. Again, I wasn't expecting to talk about Marilyn so much, but it's really apt because she did have, she spent a number of years in Japan working with the, you know, masters, I think maybe it was just one master printmaker, you know, and she brought back that Japanese influence of printmaking, really. And that had a big influence, I think, on me, the way she described the relationship with paper and the beauty of that and the ink.
Well, although actually before we move away from talking about paper, for listener reference, there's a work called T.O., from 2023, which is Ink and Oil on Board, which I think is held in the Christchurch Art Gallery collection. But yeah, for you, listener, a good reference to go and look at a work that for surface quality, in my mind, even though it's on board, looks like paper. But you just mentioned ink. So again, another Chinese invention, you know, Asian invention, certainly.
Yeah.
So another material that you've wanted to use, again, as a heritage nod. Or is it maybe it sounds like it was Marilyn as much as anything that brought you to it?
Yeah, I think there's different layers of ink. I mean, that ink was a lot more, I suppose, harder. And the printing ink is different from the washes of ink. Mm. Although the Japanese printmakers, oh my God, they're just phenomenal. You know, those with the way they work with their transparencies and things. But, you know, when I'm working with ink, with painting, it's different again because you're dealing with the flow of it. And
so washes more than...
Washes. And the first time I had my residency over in Beijing, when was that? 2005, I think, 20 years ago. I started working with ink then more so. This is when I first started working with Chinese ink. And it was incredibly intimidating to do it over there. It was like, you know, because all the ink's here, like, it's amazing. You can just get literally buckets and buckets of ink and amazing, beautiful brushes. And
not to mention a thousand years of mastery as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And here's this, you know, me over there, this rough as guts young artist, sort of having a dig at it over in Beijing on my studio floor.
But it's now
going, what am I doing? Like, am I just insulting everybody? Am I just insulting the whole tradition here? And it felt like I was.
But it's turned into a medium now that you use just about in every work, right? So it's one you've really fallen in love with.
20 years later, I've actually able to feel a bit more comfortable with it, really. It's tentative. Everything I do, even though everything I do is quite tentative as well. It's this balance being tentative and also reckless. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does.
A lot of people don't see the reckless side because I don't know if you've ever seen a photo of my studio or image of my studio, but it's absolute chaos.
you obviously need to create a little bit of chaos to end up with these works that look so beautiful.
Yeah. And that's what's often people come into my studio, freak out. But then they do realize that's the yin and the yang. There's that solitude that comes from it.
And then woodblock as well. Again, another Chinese invention and one that you use a little bit in printing process.
Mm. Actually, the more you talk about the printing process, I think that's why I leaned more towards printmaking than painting when I was at art school and things, because it did have that, yeah, it did have that tradition to it. And so the aesthetic aspect was sort of taken away. It was shifted, and I didn't have to conform as much, I suppose. What was the question again? Printmaking?
Using woodblocks, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really think about that culture as a cultural connection, but the carving aspect, there's a Māori reference to that as well. Mm. Actually, I've got a funny story if you want. You want a little funny story?
Please.
So we were up at Wānaka up in the Hokianga a number of years ago, probably about 10, 15 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. It was an Indigenous exchange up there, and a lot of our Māori artists were up there, and we were all in different groups, you know, and Indigenous artists, Native American artists were there, some Aboriginal artists were there, and yeah, Pacific Island artists. So it was a big one for a week. And we were all now, you know, people doing their clay, the carvers were there, the printmakers were there, were painters, and I was hanging out with the printmakers, and it's quite a female dominated practice, printmaking. So as a male, and I'm used to that, I was brought up with all my aunties and lots of, yeah, anyway, I don't even notice these things anymore. But when we were there, we were as the printmakers, and we were off printmaking and doing our workshops, and you know, I was the only male there amongst all the other female Māori printmakers, who were amazing. And I remember Brett Graham was up there with us too. And Brett was over with the carvers. He comes up and comes over to me. He says, "Oh, Simon, all so macho over there. They're all so just wielding their big axes and their big tuki and just like chunking into this. It's all so macho. And it's kind of come and join with you guys." And I go, "Yeah, like, I know it's probably not very politically correct, but I said, "Yeah, we're the lady carvers over here, Brett. Come and join us."
Just gently working with printing.
We're like the gentle little carvers, you know, but you know, we're doing with our little gentle carving tools, and then the guys over there with their big other. It was funny.
That's probably a nice reflection, actually, of something I wanted to ask, or a nice reflection of this next question. The printing process for you was more about process and what it could achieve rather than churning out multiples, right?
Yeah.
And I know you work in multiples sometimes.
No, I hardly ever work in multiples, but yeah. Mm. Yeah. So far
more about process.
That's right.
A strong sense that it could achieve different things, if not a lot more maybe than painting could.
And it's really quick. It's a really quick process, and I'd like to work fast and on a lot of work at the same time. I build up probably, you know, 4 or 5, 6, 7 works all at the same time. Yeah, so like, you know, that's a part of the process. But I think also, you know, I just use that word gentle. I think, you know, my work is gentle.
Yeah.
And I suppose some people sometimes see me as gentle.
Yeah. I'm gonna come back to that, because it's funny, gentle is one of the words that I had down on some of these questions as well. But before we maybe move off Chinese, and I'm being a little binary here with this, but also I wanted to ask about the moon, because it's so often, if not always, a motif that exists in work.
Mm.
And also looking at so much Chinese art, the moon is so often present. So, and again, for listener reference, there's a series, well, just about anything. There's a moon in a Simon Kahn work, but I'll include images of something from the Noho Aka series from 2024. Another piece of...
Yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours about the moon and the idea around marama and maramataka, around understanding, around enlightenment. The moon, at one stage, initially was a square. It was just a little square of light. So if you go further back into my work, there would be this little break of light that comes through that skin in my work, and kind of actually originated a little bit from when my lovely grandmother passed away back in 2000. And I did a work for her, and I just had this little square, and it was like this gap to sort of escape through, you know, or that, not escape through, but just to traverse through, or to, you know, as a shift of state.
Portal to other
as
realm.
A portal. Yeah, exactly. So this little square was a portal, and then there'd be a little gap in the horizon, just that little thing of light that between two horizons that you'd probably another portal. And then I used that for quite a long time, actually. And there was, you know, so every time you see that little sort of snippet of light and some of the work, that's that portal and about her departing. And a lot of the work also, I mean, I talk about my quite a lot over the years about, you know, my father passing away and how that triggered a massive shift in my thinking about from wanting to make art to really needing to make art, to find sort of some sense in the world for myself. And anyway, so those things of those portals around sort of transformed into a moon form. And I remember when I first did my first round paintings, that was in Wellington, in a show in Wellington, and people called them tondos. And I didn't even know what a tondo was back then. I was like, well, what are you calling it? What did you call it?
Amazing what you
can tondo. And it's like, so, you know, there's that Western perspective of that lens. And I was like, it's not a tondo. It's a moon gate. It's this Chinese reference to that portal through into another world around, you know, in Chinese gardens, right? There's, you know, the Chinese gardens with the moon, the round entranceways. That's that transition from one state to the next of spiritual worlds.
That crosses over almost perfectly with Māori and Chinese culture then. It's a huge overlap.
It's all serendipitous. So it's like, I don't overthink. I don't research these things. I don't read about these things. I just muddle through them and they sort of start making sense. It's a beautiful part of being an artist, you know, I think.
Before we move off, I suppose, motifs, also wanted to obviously talk about Māori motif that's in the work, especially waka, which seems like such a perfect motif just in terms of how much it represents. So community, collective, effort, journey. I'm assuming it's all of that and more in the works.
I mean, the waka is just a self-portrait. That's all it is. I don't try to...
I'm getting way too carried away.
People do sometimes. I like to keep it simple, and it has changed and shifted. I don't like to say what it is, because, I mean, it has changed over time. You know, I think it has represented that some. Like, I used to do multiple work. I did in works when maybe community was that, or how we interact with each other, or how we cross over at times and miss each other, or like, you know, don't understand each other, or how we just have to be together in the world, is, you know, when they're in multiples. And then when there's a singular, it takes it right back to just, it's just you and you around, you know, and creating these spaces around myself as the waka. And which then people can transport themselves into that. And then they're there in with this, you know, this sort of essence around them.
And maybe I'm taking this too literally again, but you just said creating space. Often with the works, the both landscape elements and waka, they're often quite small in what appears then as this really vast space, landscape. I'm not sure what the right word is. So do you deliberately minimise the size of those elements, those subjects in the work, I don't know, as a reflection of like, hey, we're, you know, the landscape is and the environment is much bigger than us?
I haven't thought about it that way, but I suppose even the term deliberate, the waka is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, it is. And, you know, I've been doing some large multi-panel works that are 7 meters by 2 meters. And there's this tiny little waka in it. And people still call them waka paintings. You know, and that kind of, I find that I get amused by that.
Well, I guess we all look for a subject to grasp onto.
And then that's fine. And that's fine. It's just.
So it begs the question, why do you know why they're getting smaller?
Because they're just an essence of there. And they're a trigger too. I think for me, it's just placing myself in the paintings. But I am I'm enjoying exploring. As I suppose that what, you know, you called it the wider world or wider worlds. And it is a spiritual kind of realm that I'm exploring. Yeah, without any major Thai too. I mean, I've enjoyed Taoism. There's Chinese connection there, obviously, and the Asian connection, and Buddhism are things that I probably connect to mostly.
Well, it's funny, it suggests you're resizing yourself in the world.
Yeah, I suppose, and I'm only a small little guy too, so I'm probably shrinking physically as well. Seriously, Graham, I don't overthink that. It's just I'm making stuff, and
that's right. I've overthought it for you.
Yeah, so. I mean, and that's fine. That's your job, and that's writers, and they'll have to do that too. And
well, we talked about the works being gentle, and the way that the passing of your father reframed the work for you.
Hmm.
The work really does look really meditative in that, you know, it's not dominated by a lot of subjects. There's a lot of open space.
Hmm.
They're intended to be meditative objects for you and for viewers.
Yep. Yep. They are. They're finding that it helps to slow down. Like, you know, I mentioned it right at the start, like, you know, I was real sporty and I still surf a lot. I mean, we haven't even touched on that yet. But, you know, there's a whole lot of interconnections with that. But it is around, but it's about slowing, it's about flow and about rhythms as well. And, like, I don't know, like, this is kind of left field, but not. But even like judo, right? Like judo, you play judo, there's a rhythm, you dance, like a dance, you know. And I loved it, you know, I loved the dance of that and the flow and, you know, yeah, how it all interrelates what I do without me knowing it, really. And it's just me being me, but being true to that. Look at these different strands and we go, is this me? Is this me? Is this, it's not quite me. And it's just being trying to be true to yourself when you're making work. And it's not an easy thing to do.
You've always kept that, and maybe this is being true to yourself, you've always kept the work quite tonally light. So, you know, the palette has always been quite light. Again, another way to facilitate a meditative quality?
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Or more broadly, why the light palette?
I'm just thinking about like another influence of mine, a big influence of Ralph Hotori and how he's been, you know, big part of my psyche, yet I would think I work with light in a similar way, the similar way he's worked with black.
I'm assuming you've spent some time with him as well.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, he came into my studio a few times and, you know, in his later years. And he was the first artist I sort of knew who was an artist. He used to come into the fruit shop and hang, you know, talk to Dad and stuff. And Dad would point him out to me of, oh, you know, that's Ralph. And see that car he's driving, he swapped that for a painting and that Rolls Royce. And and stuff. I was like, oh, wow. And it used to fascinate and capture my imagination when I was a kid, when Ralph would come into this fruit shop and I'd be in there. And, you know, I wasn't interested in making art at the time, but, you know.
But your palette, I distracted you from this. You're working with, sorry, lighter colours as much as Ralph was working with black.
Yeah, I think so. So, and I'd love to paint black like Ralph. You know, I'd love to do that. And I try sometimes. It's not me. It's the light and it's that white and it's not white. It's only tiny bits of white in it. And just those subtleties of tone and hue. And that's kind of, I suppose it's because it's about the sky and the water and the beauty of that. So... And the interrelationship between those two things.
Well, they also have, and again, this might be too lazy of me to refer them to them as landscape paintings. I guess the beauty of that palette is that it seems like a really gentle invitation. Like it's really easy to sink into those works as a viewer because you're not being hit with these, you know, intense or really solid colours. So again, by design is a way to allow a viewer or you to sink into landscape and sky and ocean?
Yeah. It's interesting when you talk about the term even sinking in, because I think about water, you know, sitting in water.
Yeah.
And I observe that water, whether consciously or unconsciously, when I'm that tens of thousands of hours that I've spent sitting in water. And watching the clouds, watching the sky, watching watching all those things move around. And that's a lovely thing I like about being in the water with my kids and sharing those things with them. All three of my boys I've spent time in the water with, probably the oldest Kahu more than the others, but, you know, sharing those experiences together in that immersion is really special.
That must remind you as well that you're not a dominant force, that the ocean is the dominant force when you're in it, sitting on your tiny waka, I suppose, your surfboard.
Yeah, no, very much so. And then you're only getting a small snippet of that connection when the wave comes through, of that thousands of kilometres that's travelled and that energy. I think all surfers, whether they're conscious of it or not, interact with that in their own way. And I think it's really diverse too, though. So that's why when I can say all surfers, but all surfers have a really diverse experience with that. Sometimes it's really competitive. Some use it as a really aggressive thing. Some people need it, you know, for a spiritual connection. Some people need it for healing and health.
But for you, it's meditation like the practices. There's a connection there between surfing and the practice.
Yeah, it is meditative, but also it's not always that too. Sometimes it's all those things I described just then.
Mm.
Sometimes it's frustration. Sometimes it's you know, it's all for health. A lot of it's for health now as I'm getting older. I've just been out of the water for the last 6 weeks for the first time in many, many years.
A forced retreat? Or
I've just had an ear operation from surfing.
Mm.
It's the second time I've had my ears drilled out from my bone growing over my ears.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty
common for surfers.
Yeah, it's called surfers here. But I've been out of the water for the last 6 weeks and had to separate myself from it. It's been an interesting experience, actually. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk about place overall, actually. So that's the talking about the ocean and time and a perfect lead-in, I suppose, to working in Otupoti as place, because you always have. I mean, I know there's a long family connection, but is that place important? Can you imagine the practice if you weren't living in Dunedin?
No, I suppose not. I mean, I think the thing for me living in Dunedin is it's where I was born. It's what I know. It's what's shaped me. I've lived on the harbour. Like I grew up on one side of the harbour for 20 years. In the last 20 years, I've on the other side, looking back at where I grew up. So there's sort of this duality there of that. And so experiencing it like that, and you know, maybe going back to Ralph, even like his works, I don't think a lot of people really write about his work and think about his work as that connection to that harbour. When I read a lot of his stuff, it's not about that. My feeling is it's all about that.
And your work. And your work is as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. But it's universal, you know. Water's universal, the sky is universal, and land is universal. So it's just, and I suppose it's a Buddhist reference there, isn't it? Like, you know, and Taoist, actually, of being set in one place and the universal beauty of that.
And a connection to Ngāi Tahu as well, like thinking about whenua and tribe?
There's that. I mean, I explore that in slightly different ways. Yeah, no, it's just me, really. I mean, people do like to write about those things and talk about, you know, those connections. You know, I explore my Māori whakapapa more through my food projects these days and those food connections.
Another mode of making.
Yeah. It's another layer of work that I've been doing for the last 12 years with my co-collaborator, Ron Bull, that I really love and treasure as a collaboration too. And it just takes me to different places.
Because you're a self-confessed foodie as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And then that's the partly the Chinese side of me and my whole family. You know, my brother's a chef cook, and my father was always cooking, and my mum. And yeah, so this exploration into Indigenous foods is really great as a conceptual arm to my, you know, to my a layer of making work.
And is the food another connection to ocean as well, Kai Moana?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
I was going to bring some mutton birds up for the show here this morning, for today, but I ran out of time. But yeah, we have, you know, we've often served food and stuff in here, and that, yeah, those the connections. And you know, when we were going to, you know, the beaches when we were young, it wasn't always just to run around the beach. It was always to collect kaimana or cockles and things at the time, and, you know, growing up with that and with, you know, gathering.
And that just all deepens connection to place, I suppose.
Mm. And that's something I like to do with my kids. And me and my partner Sarah would, you know, would take the kids to get cockles and stuff, and you know, giving them those childhood memories of connection to place, you know, because other things that ground you as well, you know, knowing what's around there. And, you know, now that's the great thing about Māori culture. That was your, then that's just, that was your supermarket, you know. And we just recently had a Chinese curator over here from Hong Kong, and he was asking us about, you know, where do you get Māori food? And you go, well, it's really hard unless you go to a restaurant and it's really expensive, or, you know, people who gather it. But there's no mainstream connection, you know, there's no mainstream access often to Māori food, which was really interesting to think about.
Speaking of, I guess, different modes of making, so we've talked about printmaking, painting, and the food collabs with Ron. You also do some work with Business Okaha.
Mm-hmm.
As their lead designer. So I suppose a more commercial, if that's the right word, application of practice. But that must allow you to bring some artistic knowledge into what is ultimately consultancy work. So what does that look like, the flow of artistic practice going into a much broader or bigger world of consultancy and lead design?
Yeah, that wasn't by choice going into this medium. I mean, I've been working in this field now for Okaha for 6 years. At the time, I was, you know, I had a job making art, but I was sort of pulled in by Tahu Portiki, who was the CEO of Okaha at the time, and he said, Simon, you know, we need to get our visual culture out into the world, into this place, into Dunedin, into the broader Takiwā. And I want you to come and help me do that. And I said, Tahu, you know, I'd love to, but I've got a job. I'm making art. And I, you know, I know if you pull me into this, I know it's going to be big.
But it must have been a temptation as well in terms of, like, it's another way to apply practice.
I was tempted, yeah. And then, but I knew it was going to take me out of my studio, my physical studio, a lot. And I knew it was going to be a massive transition. And I wasn't sure if I was ready for that. And then he sort of twisted my arm and said, you know, let's just start this project. Come help me with this one. And, you know, I started to turn up to meetings with architects with them. And, then got into it. And then Tahu subsequently passed away, probably not long after that, maybe 9 months after that. And I was kind of felt responsible to...
You were left holding a baton.
Left holding the baton, the baby, I call it. You know, we're working for my tribe, you know, and that Whangaito, and then the Runaka. We're owned by 7 of the Runaka to achieve this. And I remember talking to Ross Hemera, one of our senior Ngaito artists at the time. And Ross he's a, you know, amazing designer, professor, and he's worked in this space for a long time. And I said, Ross, you know, I'm really concerned about my art practice getting inhibited by not being able to spend so much time in the studio. And he just said, Simon, your studio has just extended, that your studio is much bigger now. With this, it's just extended studio,
and with that reframing, that's now how you view that work.
That helped, yeah. But yet, I think there was one question in there: how has it influenced my work?
Mm.
And it kind of hasn't, as far as my 2D, the work there. But it's a complementary practice now. It means I can explore different things in different ways as a creative design lead. Like, I don't know, I'm designing the facade of the Dunedin Hospital at the moment. That, you know, that's a $1.8 billion project, and they're trusting me to do that. And it's like, okay, it's no pressure, but, you know, it's like I kind of have to have a bit of a chuckle. I mean, I'm not a designer, but just my aesthetic.
But you are an artist, and therein lies the importance.
Yeah, and it can transfer over, you know, these skills and just the artist eye, I don't know, you know, that sensibility. And sitting with, you know, Warren Amani, they're leading it, and you know, seeing with those architects from there, and they kind of trust me, which is kind of nice. And but there's a mutual trust, and it's had its advantages of this practice that I've got here, and they're conscious of my practice, and there's a certain, I don't want to say respect, but you know, acknowledgement.
Yeah, well, collaboration.
Yeah, of wanting to collaborate with me. And it's not just me doing these works. I need to say to us, I bring other artists into these works. So it's lots of other, our carvers and our designers and our weavers and contemporary Ngaito artists who I pull into these projects as well to collaborate.
Well, and another work maybe to call out for listener reference, because they can't look at the facade for the Dunedin Hospital yet because it's not finished. But the work that you've done with Rachel Rakina, the sculpture work that sits outside Te Pai in Christchurch, the convention centre, Te Aka.
Yeah.
So maybe just a reference for listeners at least.
Yeah. I can spend another 2 hours talking about that piece too. That was a great collaboration with Rachel. Awesome. And also with Mana Whenua up there.
Yeah.
To achieve that sort of sculpture. And that's the only large sculptural artwork I've done before with Rachel and myself doing that.
Yeah, well, listener, next time you're in Christchurch, if you're in Christchurch, you can walk through a Simon Kahn work.
Yeah, it's in a three-dimensional way.
So speaking of all of that collaboration, that almost maybe not defines the last few years, but there's been a strong collaborative aspect to the last few shows and the show that we're sitting amongst at this very moment in your gallerist space in Auckland at Sanderson. So the work you've been doing with Weed for the last few years, how did you guys end up working together? Because you've known him for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I first met Wee probably 20 years ago. I think it was at another Wananga. And I was just about to jump on to, I had a big case full of artworks to take over to Australia, to Sydney and Melbourne, to traipse around to the galleries to see if anyone was interested. And yeah, we was there at the Wananga, and I said, oh, I'm just heading off where I've got all my stuff. He goes, oh, go kill it over there, Simon, you know, and gave me that boost of encouragement and said, just, you know, just go and own it. And then from there, we swapped some artwork at the time around then. He had a beautiful big piece at Kura Gallery, actually, in Wellington. And they were really supportive back then of a lot of the young Māori artists coming through, and, you know, not young, but just everyone really, or pulled towards there. And it was back in the time, really, where contemporary galleries, art galleries, our mainstream dealer galleries weren't as interested in showing us then. And the likes of Kura Gallery were and that they embraced us, and a certain amount of energy there. I think that needs to be acknowledged, actually. It's something that's not acknowledged too much. Yeah, so, you know, we swapped some work, and, you know, I've lived with his work from then, and his work lived with mine, and we've crossed paths at different wānanga and hui through that time.
And I should actually take this opportunity to highlight to listener that Wee's work, very different for yours, or at least completely different medium, works in uku, clay, versus obviously, you know, painting, printing for you.
Yeah.
So how does the collaboration work now? Because you're not just showing together.
No. We've been down to Dunedin a number of times for working down there in residencies, and we killed him down last year for another residency just to work for our show. And, you know, during those times, I think we've got a mutual just understanding, but also an acknowledgement and appreciation for each other's work. And sometimes, you know, I used to think about how my waka and forms would create, you know, be able to be produced in clay works and things. And we had discussions around that a few years ago, and we started making some together, and I was learning more about clay with him. And then he looks at my surfaces and goes, oh, wow, you know, I could turn that into a glaze, or, you know, and then we just hatch kind of some crazy plans together. And we look at our connections. We actually got whānau connections as well, which is really lovely. We've got one of our favourite uncles. We share a same favourite uncle. So we've got that nice whānau connection. And we've got a similar energy, I suppose, to our work.
Well, you just talked about admiration for his work.
Mm.
The works that are in this show, which is kind of a first for Simon Kahn, or a new way of for you making, are these what are kind of portraits of him or portraits of his clay works, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I've been painting, I did three paintings of his, of three of his quite iconic, or I call, I think iconic works of his that, that I really, really wanted to respond to. So I made these paintings, and it was a really beautiful process for me over the last number of months. I'm immersing myself in these forms of Wee's physically in painting form, and not trying to reproduce them as such. You know, I didn't want to paint them to make them, you know, the shapes are there, but the essence or the inside is mine. It's me and me and him combined, and turning them into these landforms. When you talk about landform, there's no land in them.
Oh,
you know, it's the uku. Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, true. That is the whenua, yeah. But, you know, and connecting, trying to, I suppose, creating a Māori within them that's both of us. And then bringing his pots in last night when they arrived with the paintings is just super special. It's and, like, oh my God.
And again, for a listener that doesn't appreciate the nature of the shows, you're showing, or Wee's showing his ceramic work.
Yeah.
Pot work.
Maybe you could post an image of the show. Really great.
For sure.
Because I think, yeah, it's something that's it's got me really excited. Really, I mean, Lydia here is saying it's, you know, it's such
Lydia, your gallerist at Sanderson.
Yeah, Lydia's been so encouraging and so supportive of Wee's practice as well. And we need that. We need a whole team. You know, as Wee's getting older too. I mean, it's kind of nice to talk about these things, I think. As an aging artist and mid-career artist,
yeah.
You like to call me.
Well,
and supporting each other. We need a community around. We need these people supporting. We need our gallerists and our dealers, not just there to sell work, but to help them make work and to be the bigger journey, you know, and all the needs that go around that.
I appreciate with the relationship that you guys have in terms of making together that this real exchange.
Mm.
But for you and your relationship with Wee, is it one of looking to the wisdom of Kaumātua and drawing on that?
I think with the two of us, it's just riffing off each other, to be honest.
Mm.
You know, it's just I think when, you know, you get two artists together and, you know, any other artists who collaborate together, you've got to gel, and, you know, we gel together. We talk about some really fascinating things together that helps to promote our work, helps to stimulate new thinking with our work. And that's really exciting. And I need that. And I think Wee probably needs that too. And I think a lot of artists need that to, it's kind of like, it's like being a team, you know, becomes from an individual practice to a team game.
Well, he certainly seems to have changed your practice because, as I say, these are the first time we're seeing these vessel paintings of yours that, again, tribute to portrait of sorts of Wee's, and they're amazing paintings. So he's kind of, you know, moved your practice sideways a little bit.
Yeah, it was even interesting you talking about them as my works. They're kind of our works. You know,
yeah.
I feel uncomfortable thinking of them as my works.
True collaboration.
Really, it's so, you know, we're both in that, in that together, really. Yeah, so,
and this is probably unfair to ask you this question, but if I can, are you aware of what exchange means for Wee, like the elements that he's taking or the elements that he's enjoying of your practice and bringing into his?
You know, our practice comes together. I think the collaboration happens when it's in the space here together.
When you're presenting the show.
When we're presenting the show together and seeing the works together and the conversations that they have next to each other, the strong Lang reference, and then the elements around the land, which is the water and the sky, makes them complete.
And it really does feel like when you walk into the space here with the show hung, it feels like you are walking into all those elements, into a landscape almost.
Hmm. It's sort of, it makes every, yeah, it's a completion. And not often in art, when you're in the art, making art or even, there isn't often completion. anyway, it's not a final completion, but for now this feels complete. You know, there's a complete sort of grounding and understanding, and even I can use the word Māori or Wairua that's created, that can only be created when the works are together. Yeah.
And it sounds like then that collaboration is just becoming more and more entwined in you and what the work is.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'll go away and back into my studio in Dunedin, and we will be back in his studio in Wellington, and we probably seriously won't even be thinking about what each other's doing, and that's totally fine. We're not going, I'm doing this, can you, you know, but we'll have conversations on the phone, and for this one, I've been sending him photos of work happening, and he's inputted into ideas around it, and I think into the painting, which has been great.
And maybe this is going back to the very start of the conversation, but I suppose maybe even more broadly, is it also an acknowledgement of sorts that you owe a debt, not just to Kaumātua like we in collaboration, but previous generations as well?
Yeah, when you think about the intergenerational nature of Māori practitioners, there's, you know, that whakapapa of it is always omnipresent. But also, I think we're all together at the same time. It's not lineal. And the fact that tōkana tēnā can work together in the present time is a really beautiful thing. You know, we haven't started talking about paimanu yet, or if we're going to, but, you know, like the Ngaitu Contemporary Artists Network, when we collaborate, we've just done a big collaboration over in Asia Pacific Triennale in last year, and there was 50 of us, 50 artists around that, pulling together this one big project, and multi-generational. You know, I had my son there, Kahu was over with me, which was great, and the first time we sort of, you know, worked together. And just the beauty of that is how it should be. You know, and how it used to be, and it's about community. It's about making work as community and the power of it.
And all of that is present in any given single work of yours.
That's individual practice, you know, but the stuff around community practice from a Māori perspective, what really makes my heart sing, just the importance, I suppose, of having this, I sometimes get in trouble for saying this, but I think we're kind of like a sub-tribe of artists.
Artists are a sub-tribe.
Yeah, like as paimanu, we're like a sub-tribe of ngaitahu, because we're creatives and we're creating this language.
You're the gentle printmakers off to the side.
Yeah, not all printmakers. We're all different. Yeah, we've got our painters. Yeah. We've got our, you know, we've got our rock stars in there. You know, we've got our young ones. We've got our people on the fringe. We've got our writers. A lot of us have known each other now for years and years and years. You know, like, and that's a beautiful thing of my contemporaries. You know, it's myself and Rachel, who you've mentioned, collaborating, and there's Areta Wilkinson, she's like an auntie to my kids, and Ross Hemera, who's, you know, he was out there doing it by himself for many, many years, because he's, you know, he's a next gen, earlier generation, but when he found us and we found him, he had a people of Ngaito creatives, and it just brought this new spark of life into his way of being. He's acknowledged that, and we acknowledge him as that po for us. But and the young ones coming through, and I'm the art dad and art uncle to them, you know, and we kind of have a laugh about that, but that's kind of it, you know. We're a whole, and the beauty of making artwork together, and that's an intimate type of, and it is intimate in many ways, way of, from a cultural perspective, it's really exciting. It's a new wave of making contemporary Māori art. That's how it should be. So,
last question, and one that I ask everyone, removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work in general would you love to live with?
Oh, that's, yeah, I've sort of gone around in circles on that. But I think I've sort of settled on not just one single work, but maybe one single work that I don't even know the name of, but it was a piece of work that I experienced probably 25 years ago, maybe around, yeah, around that time, 20 years ago, of Emily Kamingaware, who's an Aboriginal artist. And I first came across this work when I was in Sydney early on in my art, I suppose my professional journey as an artist. And it was at the Sydney Art Gallery. And it was a large, big black line work. When I say large, it was probably, you know, 7 metres by 4 metres.
That's pretty large.
Yeah. And she's phenomenal. She transformed the way we look at contemporary painting in the world, basically. She was in her 80s when she was doing these works, 80s. But that connection, and not just her work, but a lot of that Indigenous Aboriginal work and those paintings, but particularly hers, when I stood in front of that painting, it just totally transformed me. I had this whole internal experience of the power or the spirit of an artwork, of not even calling an artwork. It was this thing there that I stood in front of that just transformed me in a way that I got to understand the power of an artwork and the importance of that. And it was something to aspire to. And I still aspire to that. It's still a big part of me. Yeah. And other artists do that too. But that's for me, that's the, I suppose the acid test of whether a work is ready. That's where I'm trying to get to, you know, or I'm only touching the surface with that. That work, they just go so deep, and they're so entrenched in whakapapa of that land over there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's just phenomenal.
As always, thank you for listening. If you'd like to know more about the availability of work by Simon, contact Sanderson Gallery in Auckland, Gallery 33 in Wanaka, or De Novo Gallery in Otipoti. This is the final episode for the 2025 season, but please join me for season 4 of The Good Oil, launching in March 2026. Until then, please have a great spring and summer. Ka kite anō.